Assalamu alaikum. Welcome back to the podcast. Wow, it's been 2 years since we last spoke. And welcome back to Profiled, an NCCM podcast. My name is Omar Kamisa. And as always, I'm joined by NCCM CEO, Mustafa Farooq. Mustafa, man, it's been 2 years since we've been on this.
Salaam, yeah, that's so true. I think this means that the next time we put another episode,
we just do a podcast every 2 years.
We have some proper distancing in between episodes. Yeah, exactly. That's man. What you need.
No, you know, we were sitting over, I think it was like over the New Year break when we were just trying to think about new things to do with, you know, NCCM. And it's been one of those things that we've been wanting to start again for quite a while. I think every couple of months we're like, you know, let's get this podcast going again. Let's figure out a way that we can launch it. But it's just been so hectic over here. So hectic. So what did, we really decided that, you know, now's the time. It's now or never. It's been 2 years since our last episode. Let's start it up with a little bit new of branding, change the game plan a little bit. Let's have a few different kind of conversations, not just about, you know, with politicians, but about culture, about what's happening, about things that are really affecting our community.
100%. No, I was just going to say that, like, I think one of the things that I always hear people talk about is like so many of the files that we work on, like you really need to kind of have a full discussion about it. You need to kind of do a full deep dive and a full analysis. And we think that this is a great place to do that. But also it feels like there aren't a lot of spaces where we can do a deep dive into other things that we're all thinking about and talking about that maybe deserve that kind of space for that kind of discussion. So that's why we decided to bring the podcast back.
I've said it multiple times. It's one of my most favorite things to do at NCCM. Just the podcast, having a chance to talk to you. And, you know, what I often find is that, you know, here at NCCM, we do these cases that are incredibly complicated or have so many different layers to it. Like, for example, like Bill 21 or the Special Envoy, that, you know, when you hear these words, you hear these terminologies, they just seem like, you know, legal jargon or political jargon. And, you know, for myself, it's something that I think before I came to NCCM, I wouldn't have had any idea what that meant. Right. Or like our London Family Act. It sounds amazing. It sounds like it's something that would change, you know, the world, change the province, make our family safer. But I think it's just having a chance to sit down and really talk about it on a personal level. You know, why it's important for our families, for our loved ones, for our community. And, you know, that's always been something for us that has been so, you know, intrinsic to the work that we're doing and so important to make sure that, you know, we're not just talking at a corporate level, at a political level, really at a community level where, you know, each and every one of us want the same thing, to make sure that, you know, our family is safe in Canada, to be Muslim and to be ourselves.
I think that's 100% accurate. And I think like part of it is also just that, you know, even beyond sort of diving into like what we're doing at NCCM, just even understanding the problems that are in front of us, it can seem so confusing and strange and all over the place. You know, there's so much sort of layer of complexity and jargon that gets thrown your way that even for basic things that you should have an understanding about, you don't necessarily get that, you know, understanding just from learning about it or just trying to do a little bit of research. So that's the point of this podcast.
You know, what's been happening with NCCM lately?
Oh my God. Have you ever seen, you know, Jacinda Ardern, the Prime Minister of New Zealand, she does this thing where she does like a breakdown.
Yes, this is what we need right now.
The last 2 years and 2 minutes. We need to do one of those at a separate point. I feel like one of the things that we've been kind of getting up to has been really moving a lot of policy, but also fighting some of the most important legal battles, doing a lot of education work, a lot of media work, a lot of storytelling, and a lot of community mobilization. And I guess that we could talk about that and unpack that for a long time. But I think really, I think the biggest and the most profound moment has sort of been just getting to know folks and getting to understand what they're passionate about and what they're working on and working together to build something better. I mean, like shout out right now to Sheikh Mamoun Hassan, who's kind of helping, you know, pull this podcast together on the technical side. Who, you know, has been talking about ways of doing better storytelling for a long time. It's that kind of collective kind of effort when we come together, when we work together, that we can make some.
Storytelling, you know, I think is something that we've been lacking on for a while. you know, even just the some of the cases that we've been dealing with and handling, I think it's, you know, such an important aspect to sit down and actually break it out. And I think, you know, we've had those conversations too of, you know, long form and short form storytelling and how we can actually break it down. And I'm really excited to be able to have this platform again, to be able to discuss that with folks, you know. And I think that's, you know, as I was saying, our goal is to have this as a weekly podcast. Going forward, we can really break down, you know, things that are happening, storytelling, you know, avenues that, you know, have expressed people, and really do a deep dive into, you know, a bigger understanding. And, you know, issues, problems. And, you know, I think that kind of leads us to something that's been happening recently, right? And, you know, you are based in Ottawa. You've heard the honking night and day, the orchestra of honking night and day. How has that been for you and the family there?
It has been quite the adventure. I mean, they're literally like right outside my door when I walk down. So here at the NCCM office, we're right in the heart of downtown, maybe a few blocks from Parliament Hill. I met the first Muslim that at the convoy. So, you know, for those of you who aren't aware, you know, in Canada, there's a big thing right now where there's a lot of folks who are protesting ostensibly vaccine mandates. But the leadership of the convoy has some questionable ties to white supremacist groups. And the vast majority of folks who are here, in Ottawa, at least I can say, are white folks. But I met my first Muslim.
So wait, are you going down and actually talking to people and like meeting them? Like what's that like?
Yeah, every single day. So every single day I go down and have a conversation with folks, because mostly I think it's important that if we're going to try to understand a movement, we actually have to have a conversation. It's not helpful to kind of sit in your ivory tower and, you know, throw things up on Twitter or call politicians or things like that when you haven't done a deep dive analysis of what folks are talking about. And so I think I've probably talked to over 100 to 200 protesters since this thing started.
I'm going to guess, and, you know, from things that I've heard as well, is the majority of the folks that there aren't, you know, don't have those kind of ties in the background, that they're all there for different reasons. Like, what's your sense of folks that you've spoken to? Like, why are they out there? Why are they gathering?
I think there's a lot of different reasons. I mean, obviously, I think the leadership is on its own thing. And I think that leadership needs to be criticized and critiqued and dealt with a little differently. But I think there's a lot of folks with a lot of different kinds of perspectives. I mean, you got some folks who are out there who straight up just want to see the end of vaccine mandates. And whether or not, you know, agree or you disagree with that from a policy perspective, that's what they're there for. Then you have a lot of other folks who are there very straightforwardly because they want to tear down the government. And many of them who fundamentally believe that Justin Trudeau should be held personally liable for war crimes and held, you know, to trial by them. And there's a large number of those folks who are out here. And then there are some who are like straight up also like white supremacists. So you really kind of have a split.
You have the mixed bag of folks that are like kind of all come together. You know, I think that's been one thing that has, you know, really impressed me. And I think we spoke about it as well, is just that, you know, this has been something that, you know, there's been almost people from all these different walks of life. And a lot of time I've spoken to folks that don't really know what the leadership is, right? That they're only there because they believe that this is just about, you know, anti-vax or anti-mandate. And for them, they raised $10 million on GoFundMe that has now been, you know, reversed. But I feel like they've done a good job masking the white supremacy in another issue. You know, masking the kind of shady ties of leadership into another issue there.
Well, I mean, I think part of it is also like, just frankly, I mean, obviously like NCCM, our focus is on Islamophobia. But I think just really palpably, when I talk to a lot of folks feel that the policy of some of the vaccine mandates don't make a lot of sense. And to be fair, this is something I've heard from members of the Muslim community as well, including folks who are physicians, who feel that, you know, not all of the government's, like not every government policy from every level of government has necessarily made a lot of sense since the beginning of the pandemic. Plus, I mean, we all know folks who have lost jobs, who have lost loved ones, who have lost so much more in this pandemic. And there's no doubt about the fact that mental health, even in the Muslim community, has reached an epidemic crisis point. And I think we can't ignore those issues because they have direct ramifications on our community, how people worship, how people come together. And so these are things that affect us just as much as anybody else. But I do think there's a way in which the white supremacist stuff can.
Yeah, I feel like that's, you know, there was a time where it just kind of got swept under, it kind of changed, and you still see those flags, you know, you still see a flag of the white supremacist flag that's been flying, whether it's the 3%ers, whether it's, you know, the base, whether it's one of those flags that are just flying. You see a lot of anti-Semitic remarks as well that are out there, and I think it gets swept under the fact that they've all kind of come together, right? And you know, it's kind of been forgotten when it comes to it. And you know, for me, it's just like, you know, when did it change? How did they, you know, how did they kind of sweep that under? And you know, how they've built this much support, and that they're still being in those flags, you know. And I saw a study, and you know, I don't know how authentic it was. It was just talking about how a large percentage of the funding of this has not come from Canadian dollars, which is kind of a little bit more alarming to me of where this funding is actually coming from to fund this kind of, you know, almost hostile takeover kind of attempt.
Well, I mean, I think it's like, I mean, obviously there's a huge number of trucks outside right now that have like, that are flying American flags. I mean, there's a large number of folks who are supporting this from the US. There's just no doubt about that. But I think it's also important to just think about, like, and I'm sure we'll talk about this more when our guest comes on today, but I think it's also important to just acknowledge that there are a lot of folks who are organizing this, who are, you know, very obliquely members of the Muslim, members of the Canadian community, not the Muslim community, but members of the Canadian community. So for example, people like Tom Quicken, Benjamin Dichter, Pat King, Tamara Luck, these are folks who are Canadians and who are leading much of the convoy organizing. And like, I mean, I could talk a lot about Benjamin Dichter or Tom Quicken. These are sort of well-known figures in terms of Islamophobia stuff. And I think it's a lot of things that people need to be aware of. In fact, this brings me back full circle to the story I was saying about the first Muslim folks that I met at the convoy. So I was actually went down to the convoy. It was like after Isha prayer. I was going back home after work. And when I was going back home, I saw, you know, a Muslim couple with a young child, you know, coming to the protest. And so I said, oh, assalamu alaikum, brother and sister. My name is Mustafa. I work with this organization called the National Council of Canadian Muslims. I just want to have a quick conversation with you about why you're getting involved in the protest. And they're like, okay, you know, thank you so much for stopping us. You know, the reason that we're involved is that we have these concerns around the rad vaccine mandate. We have some concerns around the way that this seems endless, that there's no end in sight, that there doesn't appear to be a clear policy that helps people get through their jobs, loss, and things like that. And I sort of said, you know, are you familiar with this person named Pat King? And there was a person who came from behind who was wearing a Viking mask, like a Viking helmet with like the horns. You know, like remember those pictures that were floating around after the Capitol attack? Literally is the same kind of gear, get up. So he comes out from behind, he's wearing his Viking, you know, hat and says, oh, look, the mainstream media is here spreading lies. You know, in reality, Pat King is like the nicest person. You know, he comes every day, he gives us hug, he gives us love, nothing but love out here, right? And, you know, I spoke to this couple and I said, you know, the reality is that, you know, Pat King is a pretty, you know, notorious Islamophobe. You know, he has a great, you know, replacement theory that he talks about in terms of the, you know, this conspiracy that Muslims are someday planning on replacing all the people who live here, et cetera, et cetera. You know, after this, you know, we had this sort of very long discussion. I think the couple did leave. So I was kind of happy to see that. But nevertheless, I think it kind of speaks to the fact that a lot of us just have no idea, like a lot of people in the Muslim community don't really have a strong idea.
Yeah, I think that makes it a tough one for a lot of, you know, Muslims that I've spoken to as well, where there's been a percentage of the Muslim community that I've spoken to that are, you know, that have their feelings about vaccines and have their feelings about mandates and, you know, vaccine passports and, you know, and getting the jab, right? Like they have those feelings, right? And, you know, for me, it's, you know, in a society, you can disagree with it, but it's always about who your friends are. You know who your friends are and you are what your friends are is always a big sentiment of what I agree with. And, you know, you mentioned Pat King. You know, it made me chuckle over the weekend when I saw Pat King and Ezra Levant get into a little bit of a tiff, you know, and when you see those two people and Pat King and Rebel News fighting each other, it's sometimes it's a little bit funny on our end watching those two guys like go at it.
Yeah, and by the way, for those of you who aren't aware, NCCM is locked in litigation right now on behalf of a plaintiff, or one of our staff lawyers, rather, is co-counsel on a case involving a activist from Alberta who was called a thug and a number of other derogatory refugees aimed at him because he's a Black Muslim. Yeah, there's a lot of that kind of like weird back and forth, you know, who's really representing.
Yeah, I think Pat King was like, was talking about to leave Rebel News on. And I was like, if they're fighting this fight, man, I'm like, yeah, this is a, they're, I don't know what has happened here with the racist news and racist outlets here now.
Yeah, no doubt.
But yeah, that. I think for us, it's just about, you know, realizing like just, you know, when you look at the backstory, and we've done a lot of work over the past few years on the white supremacy cases, right? Like on getting organizations added to the terrorist watch list, really stemming after the incident that happened at IMO in, you know, in what was it, 2001. In 2001, it's been a lot. No, it wasn't 2001. It was 2020, right? No, yeah, no, the IMO 2020. Yeah.
September 12th, 2020.
2020, stemming after that one, it's been a lot of work that we've been doing. And, you know, just seeing some of these flags that have been flying, seeing some of the demonstrations of these of this happening really has, you know, brought a lot of memories back to me of like kind of like looking into these organizations. And it's never really a great thing. And inshallah, when we do speak to our guest who, you know, has had a chance to actually look into some of these folks as well, I think it's going to be a big time. But, you know, before we get to him, you know, last thing I'm going to say is, you know, one thing I can say that without a doubt is they, you know, it really reminded me a lot of things of what happened in the Capitol. And I think it reminded a lot of folks of what happened in the Capitol. And, you know, one of the biggest sentiments that I've seen online is just, you know, what happened at the bridge in Windsor, what's happened in the Capitol, what happened in Toronto. You know, one of the biggest things were, you know, people getting flashbacks of what happened with the BLM protests and how they got shut down so quickly and how harsh and how erratic the police came with riot gear and how the difference of treatment has been for this. What have you seen in terms of like that difference, and what have you seen in terms of just like the double standards that they've been treated with?
Well, like it's a hugely complicated, and what you're talking about unearths like a bunch of different kinds of layers, right? So like first layer, like you talk about white supremacist groups in Canada, right? So, I mean, we at NCCM, but of course many others, you know, have been pointing to the danger of these white supremacist groups and these organizing capacities for many, many years. And I remember it was like screaming into the wind initially when you first started to push for challenging groups like the Three Percenters, like the Bakes, like the Proud Boys, and, you know, where people were not understanding the difficulties and the challenges associated with these groups. But then, you know, after the killing of Muhammad Aslam Zavis, we organized, and you know, thousands of members of the Muslim community came out to stand up clearly and say, "We need to take action. We need to do some work to dismantle these groups." And alhamdulillah, literally after all of you came together, after thousands of Canadians and thousands of Canadian Muslims came together, we did see action where groups like Atom Waffen, that was the parent group of the O9A that, you know, was allegedly linked to the killing of Muhammad Aslam Zavis, were put on the list, the Proud Boys, etc. But the reality is that a lot of those core issues relating to the recruitment of white supremacist groups have still not been challenged. And that sort of takes us to the second part, which is about how do we challenge white supremacist groups? And how do we challenge these folks who are on our streets right now, some of whom are flying white supremacist stuff, some of whom are not, some of whom are armed, as we saw in Alberta today at the border crossing in Coutts, some of whom are not, some of whom are there with their kids. How do you challenge the complexity of these things? Because responding to it, and then you bring up the BLM, you think about Indigenous protests.
The Indigenous protest is always the one that hits us. Because like every time the Indigenous have that protest about whether it was the pipeline or whatever was happening in Alberta, you see that kind of like the riot gear come out and 10 people kind of get rushed kind of thing.
Yeah, but I mean, I think you have to think on the, like on, in thinking about a coherent policy approach here. Do we want to see the entrenching of the police state? And I think this is critically important, as you know, the Prime Minister today talked about the invoking of the Emergencies Act. How do we think about the entrenchment of a state that we know is often not friendly to minority communities in order to counter a group that's led largely by groups who are part of white supremacist groups or who have ties to white supremacist groups? So I think that's actually probably a great segment to bring in our guest.
I think that it really is. And So that does take us to our guest for today. And we're welcome and we're excited to have Stephen Zhao joining us on this podcast. Stephen, as I was pulling up your bio, honestly, it's one of those bios that I really didn't need to pull up. But for those that don't know who Stephen is, he is now working here at NCCM as a content writer. But previously, he's one of those... He's one of those superstar journalists that really don't need an introduction. He does writings on national security, politics, foreign affairs, foreign far-right extremists. And, you know, he's written for CBC, for Vice, for the Ottawa Citizens previously. And, you know, Stephen, as I was going through your bio here that we have, I noticed that you're in some NBA fantasy leagues. I feel like, you know, we need to have a full conversation about this because the time I'm not working, I'm playing different kind of, you know, fantasy sports, whether it's hockey, basketball, baseball. I'm in all of them right now. So I think we need to have a full discussion of making like an NCCM basketball league or something.
We can make another podcast about that.
Yeah, I think we have to have a full conversation. Most of us are going to join and pick the rap.
I'll
the
rap be here players. To talk about Enes Kanter.
Enes Freedom. Enes Freedom.
And his advocacy. Oh, man. So that's the limitation of what I know about sports.
That's the limitation.
Hey, thank you.
But yeah, Stephen, thank you for joining us. We're having a discussion today about, I really got into talking about the convoy and talking about, you know, some of the white supremacy groups that are in the... that are in the kind of the background of building it up. And, you know, when we were discussing this kind of podcast before we put it together, we really wanted to bring you on because, you know, on Twitter last week, you had a pretty deep dive thread of going down in the streets of Toronto, you know, near Queen's Park and talking to folks. And we really just wanted to bring you on to get your insights through all, you know, the work that you've done in the past for Vice, for CBC, but as well, just that, you know, hearing from people on the ground of what you've seen, what it's like, and you know what where we go from here.
And on my end, I want to talk to you about, because literally right now, the Prime Minister is invoking the emergency in response to the ongoing protests.
Yeah.
So much to discuss.
It's a lot. And, you know, like, it's one of those things where coverage has kind of changed over the past few weeks. When it first started, I wasn't surprised to see, you know, the media outlets being very kind of careful in trying to label this whole thing as white supremacist or not. And usually, you know, it's editors and so forth are very, very careful about trampling or depicting someone's right to protest as illegitimate or, you know, inappropriate because, you know, they're X or Y or white supremacists or not. This is the same thing that kind of happened, if you remember, a few years ago with the United We Roll situation, that convoy out of Alberta, which ended up being a bit of a disappointment as opposed to this one.
I'm not sure what that is. Can you?
I can't remember exactly the year, but. That was basically a convoy of trucks, various vehicles and such, rolling into Parliament Hill, protesting basically the neglect by Ottawa of Western folks, prairie provinces and oil sector people, which again was at that time you saw the media saying, you know, this is And politicians like Jason Kenney was interviewed. I remember watching him about it. And he was like, well, listen, don't, you know, the people are raising issues with some of the participants, but don't let, quote, a few bad apples, unquote, tarnish the larger point being made here. This is the kind of attitude that also followed in 2019 when some people, you know, some observers wanted right after the 2019 national election, when Trudeau won re-election, to talk about the new Wexit, Western Exit Party that came out of Alberta, which was done like that. The formation of that quote unquote movement was basically in response to the Liberal re-election, and to emphasize again, like the Prairie Nations should, you know, effectively secede, because what's the point of being part of a country that doesn't care about you? that's a narrative you can look into. But again, the media at that point was like, yeah, okay, you know, these are, you know, this is a popular sentiment. Maybe there were a couple of people, crazy people involved, but don't let that tarnish, again, a popular sentiment that deserves, you know, attention and sympathy and stuff like that. And this is the same thing, you know, same thing happening here. And let me just finish off by saying, you know, the point is, and you've seen a gradual shift towards this now, with more reporting by people like Justin Ling, for example, has done very good reporting. And now, you know, Global News has caught on, The Star and so forth, that in all these instances, until like this, a few days ago with respect to this convoy, nobody has bothered to make the observation that the organizing elements have either a history or connection to far-right entities that are xenophobic, racist, Islamophobic, and often white supremacists.
You know, famously in the United Rural protest in 2019, I know this because I was at the federal court at that time, and they rolled up, and it was really like a dry run for what's happening now, like pretty much exactly the same kind of thing. The trucks rolled up on the hill. They started honking incessantly for like a couple hours. Faith Goldie went up, Andrew Scheer went up, and made some speeches. Of course, Faith Goldie is associated a lot with white supremacy. And that kind of really laid the groundwork you know, from my estimation of what's happening now.
Yeah. Well, it's a lot of the same people too. And I don't know if you want to go into the names, we can do that, but Faith Goldie's not really around that much anymore. But I think what you have is a situation where within the past, 6 or 7 years, the far right in Canada wants to try to show force in public as much as possible in order to grow itself. It's not really easy to do that, you know, sign people up to show that you have legitimacy or credibility or an ability just to become a national item. Well, that was not really possible. Didn't get much traction with United We Roll, for instance. But that has changed with COVID, with the pandemic, which has breathed a tremendous amount of life in, it's not just Canada or the far right in, you know, in the United States or whatever, but Europe and so across the world, really. And you see a platforming of that. The mandate issue, as far as I can tell, is something that reasonable people can agree or disagree over in a reasonable manner. But the issue has been captured and taken up by people like Tamara Lick, who's involved with the new form of the Wexit Party, which is the Maverick Party, and people like Benjamin Dichter, people like Pat King, who people, you know, they're desperate to distance themselves from here and there. And there's another kind of championing organization is Take Back Our Freedoms, which is the anti-vax, or, you know, they call themselves the pro-freedom or anti-mandate group that jumped on board after, I think after Pat King, or around the same time Pat King jumped on board and helped make this entire thing into a national item. Because before this, it was one guy, if you read, you know, some of Justin Ling's reports, for example, it was one guy in his truck, a guy named James Bowder, with his document, the Memorandum of Understanding. He was trying to get people to sign up to his vision of
shockingly calls for the overthrow of government, right?
Calls for the overthrow of government. Just one guy, you know, walking around, you know, doing whatever, with no attention paid to him whatsoever. But that changes when you throw 200,000 followers of Pat King into the mix, and you throw Maxime Bernier into the mix with Take Back Our Freedoms, the main kind of anti-mandate thing, and everybody else rallies around it. And they've been successful in making this into a national item, and they've been blocking the international border at 2 points. And now this is the dominant news thing. It's a great show of force for far-right elements around the country, capturing the anti-mandate, anti-vax, or anti-mandate issue, basically.
So I think this takes us to another important kind of question, which is our response to all of these things. So today, you know, NCCM and our full team of advocates in our government relations team all came together to have a conversation about response and whether the state of emergency is an effective kind of response. Because how do we see like a positive end to this kind of thing? There's a first initial kind of philosophical question is, should we have to answer that question? Like, as minority communities, should it be on us to kind of figure out how to deal with white supremacists? I think that's probably a fair question to ask. But on like from a practicality perspective, you know, with Ottawa shut down, 3 weeks of them shooting fireworks literally outside my house, like, how do we think about, for, you know, those who are listening to this, for Canadian Muslims who want to understand more, what are some of the challenges associated with calling for emergency powers? And what could that look like? I mean, Stephen, you've been studying the implications of, you know, draconian security establishments for a long time. What does that actually look like on a practical level?
Yeah, well, I think you've been working around that as well in terms of advocating, like, with respect to some of those measures. And, well, I mean, I think the parallel that some have drawn back in 2019 and 2020 with the protests up in BC and around the country against the, I think it was called the GasLink pipeline. Is that right? Now,
yeah, with the Wet'suwet'en.
Wet'suwet'en GasLink pipeline blockades, for instance, and then the railway blockades that happened a few months after. What you'll see is a massive amount of surveillance expansion of more and more Canadians who are either involved or not involved with respect to this particular movement right now, and mass arrests if they go to that length. And I think generally, I mean, the question is very tricky. Like, you know, what are we trying to achieve here? And I mean, personally, I can give you, you know, my personal perspective or whatever, but I personally see a fair bit of hypocrisy among liberals, for instance, who are happy to, talk about how much they support, you know, in their homes and whatever, look at television and talk about how much they support the, for instance, the various protests that destroy property, for example, or destroy stores. Like in 2020, the summer of 2020, that protest that I think a lot of us supported, but have a problem with civil disobedience shown by the far right. I don't know if I struggle with it, but I think the issue here is that the people have gone beyond sort of just aiming. Some of the convoy people have gone beyond just aiming their strategy or their tactics at trying to end this thing. It's more of, it involves a lot of harassment, for example, of healthcare workers, of people who are just like living their day. They're, you know, like part of their various sort of like patterns of behavior involve shooting fireworks and all that stuff. And it may seem extra, but I think it's actually a systemic problem. Otherwise, when it comes to civil disobedience, when it comes to protest, I think it's, I think we have to be very careful there.
Yeah, I'll say maybe three things to maybe get us to unpack that a little bit more, and then I think we got to move on to our next topic. But just to unpack it a little bit more, I think one thing is that I think it's hard to equivocate between a group that's led by like white supremacist groups, or like white groups that have ties to white supremacy, and groups that are fighting to protect their land. Like, to me, those seem like two slightly different things, or more than slightly different things. Cindy Blackstock, who was, of course, a well-respected advocate and lawyer for various Indigenous communities, you know, wrote a really good piece as well with Alex Neve, who used to run Amnesty International in Canada. as well as Monia Mazik, the wife of, and very, of course, the wife of Maher Arar, but also a passionate advocate for human rights, about, and I think we'll leave the article in the notes below, but she wrote this really incredible, they wrote this really incredible piece about kind of highlighting the exact issues Stephen is talking about, and calling from a policy perspective of, let's convene a national summit to actually diagram and examine the challenges around protest. I mean, I remember at the protest involving after the killing of Ijaz Chaudhry, you know, there was a huge concern that if folks, you know, set up barricades, if they set up things on lines and things like that, that there would be violence. And I mean, realistically speaking, I mean, I went to go pick up my wife from the airport, you know, during the midst of all of this. And Pat King was literally in his truck driving around the airport again and again. I can guarantee that if I was in that one of those trucks and I was leading a charge driving around the airport again and again, they would have no hesitation in, you know, firing at will. You know, there's no way that Muslims could lead a, you know, convoy protest to block an airport. Like, it just never would happen.
I think that's one of the, so I think that what you're saying is the one of the biggest things that people are the most affected by is that, like, if I was doing something, if someone that looks like me closed the border or led a protest or was honking for weeks on end at Parliament or promising to come to Toronto and Queen's Park and just, you know, stop life there, stop anyone from coming there, what would happen? You know, and I think everyone flashes back to how the police in the riot gear treated the homeless people that were in the park in Toronto last year. I forget the name, when they came in and just kind of pushed everyone out of the park when they were just sleeping there. And it kind of just flashes back to that of, like, look at that kind of different kind of treatment, right? And we both know the treatment that you get or I get when we go to the airport, you know, like, you know, just going through the airport, right? It's a much different treatment. I remember that, you know, I went to a Raptors game like 10 years ago and I was the only person randomly selected. You know, I fit some kind of profile for something, right? So that, I think, is the biggest part that everybody, you know, triggers everyone when they see it.
I was at a press conference a month ago, less than that, where Sarah Gemma, you know, who's a very passionate advocate and used to be quite involved with Black Lives Matter, you know, the Canadian branch, where, you know, she was at a protest involving these precise kinds of issues. And, you know, like, a bunch of the folks with her were, like, choked out, hijabs were torn off by law enforcement. And, like, you know, there was, like, it was a normal protest. And that's basically something that we don't talk about. So I think the core philosophical issue that Stephen is talking about, you know, struggling or maybe not struggling, but trying to just come to terms with how do we respond to violence, not so violent, you're the white supremacist group that's leading it, and you know that a bunch of the protesters are armed and some of them are calling for insurrection. How do you deal with that? How do you unpack that? And how do you deal with entrenching a security state around challenging that?
Well, you know, I guess to close, it's like, you know, the issue of what to do now versus the more philosophical issue of what protest should look like vis-a-vis law enforcement down the road, you know, whether or not you even want to have police in that capacity from a defunding perspective. I think those two are probably different issues. I mean, as far as I, you know, in my mind, I try to tend to kind of think about it that way, because right now you have a situation where these people know that, I mean, it's pretty obvious that it's not even like they want to succeed, to be honest. They say, oh, they won't leave until the mandates are lifted, but they know pretty well that the government won't do that. The government is not going to dissolve and, you know, replace itself with a committee that is selected by, you know, Tamara Lick and her, you know, steering committee or whatever they have up there. And so in this case, well, it's an untenable situation and the police might have to step in or maybe something else has to happen, but in the long term, the very least you could say is if you're going to leave these people alone, then you have to leave everybody else alone. You know, to just if we're going by that kind of if we think about it as an analogy, to extend that analogy, I think leaving aside the fact, you know, the question of when it should be applied, or when police force and violence should be applied. Well, you could say when it's not applied here, it shouldn't be applied anywhere else that doesn't approach this level of commerce disruption and various other issues, right?
Yeah, I completely agree. And when I saw the videos of what was happening in Windsor, of how, you know, that's the kind of force that was being used, I feel like it should be just kind of unilateral across the board. And I think that's something that we definitely need to look into and definitely need to kind of pay attention to as we go through it. And I think, you know, both you guys are on the right point. So I really thank you, Stephen, for taking the time out today, for coming to be part of this discussion. And I don't think it's going to be the last one we have. I think we're going to be, you know, having this discussion a few times for the rest of the year. But thank you for, you know, for your time today, for your insight. And honestly, man, just keep, you know, smashing that work that you've been doing. You've been absolutely smashing it lately.
You guys too. Thank you so much. There's going to be, keep an eye, you know, for sure on the reporting on this and how it resolves itself will have implications, like Mustafa was saying, for how these things and civil disobedience is dealt in the future. Thank you.
Awesome, man. And before you go, where can people find you if they want to read more of the stuff that you do?
Follow me at Twitter, at StevenZzHou. Thank you.
Awesome. Follow him on Twitter. You can honestly just search his name on, if you want to see any of the writings that Stephen does, you can look online. He's putting articles out there every week about this different kind of stuff and doing the in-depth investigation. So thank you so much, Stephen.
Inshallah. NBA fantasy basketball next time, inshallah.
But we're going to talk about that. I'm literally messaging you after this call.
Okay.
And I'm going to be like, how do I join your league next year?
Okay.
Because I need to join your league and then see what other kind of fantasy basketball you play.
All right. Sounds good.
Take care, bro.
Let's talk about the Super Bowl. Let's talk about the Super Bowl. I don't want to talk about the actual game.
No, now you're getting into my kind of conversation. I don't want to talk
about the halftime show either. I'm not sure if I'm fully qualified to talk about the halftime show.
We are definitely going to be talking about the halftime show.
The only person I went in yesterday, I watched with my wife, and I said the only person who I feel an affinity to is Odell Beckham Jr. And I'm pretty sure that's because his last name Beckham is, you know, like, it's like sound like, you know, David Beckham, who I know from soccer. So I feel like an affinity there to a sport that I actually know.
Oh, bro. So I watch football like every week. And I went into the game cheering that the Bengals would win because they've had years of like hardship on their franchise. And I feel like as a Leafs fan, I sympathize for that. But as the game went on, I realized I was cheering for the Rams because they have so many like old people that are about to retire that I just want them to all like just be happy. And then when Odell went down with the injury in the first like half, man, I was heartbroken for the man. You could see him crying on the sideline.
What do you want to talk about? The coolest ad that I have seen, and I think what the implications are for the Muslim community.
All right. Well, what was the what ad stood out the most?
100% the ad with the bouncing QR code.
Yo, what? I thought my screen was frozen.
Let's see if I can send that here.
Yo, I legitimately was like looking at my TV and I thought like an error went wrong with my TV first, and then I had to scan it.
Let me see if I can pull that up.
I had to scan it. I was so intrigued by this ad, and it was like a full minute of it just bouncing on corner to corner, corner to corner. I read that, so this commercial cost them $14 million and it crashed their site right away. Like as soon as everyone started scanning it, it crashed their site.
I think the reason this is so interesting from my perspective is thinking about the Muslim community and cryptocurrency. Because obviously the ad itself, you scan the ad and it links to Coinbase, which is essentially a crypto.
It goes to the site, yeah.
I think this is one of the most interesting things that I saw in the Super Bowl, which is the democratization, like more and more ads. There were just so many ads. Of course, this one.
There were so many ads about crypto. I swear every commercial break, there was another one.
And I think one of the most interesting parts of this is how people in the Muslim community are dealing with the advent of new kinds of currencies and the lack of regulation accordingly. And I'll say that I know somebody personally who lost their entire life savings on a crypto trade where they, you know, put all of their life savings into crypto and they literally lost everything. I think it takes us to a broader conversation around the lack of, like, just very straightforwardly, like, we have a lot of, you know, folks who are doing Islamic finance stuff in Canada, but with very little regulation or oversight or analysis.
Yeah, I think the education is not there. And I think that's one of the biggest things. And I've seen quite a few of the sheikhs and the teachers now starting to do more education on cryptocurrency and what to do about it. But I think, like, as you know, if the Super Bowl is any kind of indicator on it, it's going to be something that's going to get even bigger than it already is, right? Because, you know, we saw more than I've ever seen before ads on, you know, Coinbase, on different cryptocurrencies. And I think just knowing how to handle that kind of situation, you know, I think, you know, it is, you know, very intriguing to a lot of people, you know, having this kind of currency that can go up. But it's also that understanding of what goes up and down, the halal ramifications of it as well, I think, is something that people are curious about. But, you know, the thing that got me the most, you know, really, you know, got my attention the most was everyone else spent all this time, like, trying to produce, like, the best kind of ad. You know, we had Arnold Schwarzenegger being, like, Santa Claus. We had, you know, all of these, like, stars in different kind of ads, right? And the only one that really, like, I remember there was the Lord of the Rings one. There was the, you know, the Marvel one. There was one about, like, with the Jeopardy guys. But the only one that I remember was a little box bouncing around the screen, and how they were able to take our attention from all this, like, jam-packed, fun, crazy stuff that goes, like, with the Super Bowl, the pop and circumstance. And the thing that got us the most attention, or got my attention the most, was this little square for a minute just bouncing around the screen.
I think that might just speak also to, like, how I think sometimes in our own communities, we overcomplicate the concept of how to do storytelling. Like, I can say this for myself first and foremost. You know, like, a lot of times we'll think about something like, okay, we have this, you know, we want the Muslim community in Canada to understand this issue. Like, let's say the CBSA, right? So, like, the Canada Border Services Agency, we know there's major problems with systemic racism and Islamophobia at the agency. We, you know, want to make sure there's an oversight bill that comes for this session. We want to make sure that the Muslim community is advocating to make sure that this oversight bill gets passed. And so we'll create all of these very complex, complicated messages to make sure that people understand the issue, can deal with the issue, and can challenge to make sure that we actually get the policy change that we need. And alhamdulillah, when we know that when our community gets behind something, it actually moves things forward in a really positive manner. And we've seen that, like, time and time again, just this month with the commitment of the, you know, the special office on Islamophobia. But I think what it also kind of taught me, that sort of bouncing square, is even for incredibly complex things like crypto, which, to be honest, just looks like NFTs and things like that, I don't really understand it. But the democratization and the assumption that, you know what, folks are smart. If people want to get involved, they will figure it out. I think that kind of assumption and that approach from a philosophical perspective on the democratization of knowledge is perhaps one that at least it's important for us to reflect on, even if we don't necessarily accept all of the philosophical underpinnings of the way that you do advertising.
Yeah, I think for me, it wasn't the fact that it was crypto. It was the fact that they were the only ad that grabbed my attention, right? And it was like the music they put on it. I think it was also, you know, flashbacks to, and I think a lot of us, like, you know, our 80s and 90s kids, like, enjoyed the halftime show, but it was also a flashback to that, of, like, the DVD sign bouncing around the screen, waiting for it to hit the corner. Like, it flashes back to that and the excitement that we get when it's, like, about to hit the corner. And I think Coinbase, like, played off that. It played off the fact that, you know, there was so much hype. Everyone puts all this, like, money and, like, you know, tries to overcomplicate it, things like you said. And, you know, for myself, you know, and, you know me, I've been a hard pusher on, you know, the TikTok videos and the simplification of everything. It really, like, played into me of just like, hey, all these guys, all they need to do was realize that go against the grain. Everyone else is throwing all their, like, these big fireworks and everything to it. And, like, the simplest ad of the night is the one that paid off. And the simplest ad is the one that everyone is the one that Coinbase leaped. And then it was also the fact that there were, like, 10 other different crypto people doing an ad. And the only one we can remember is Coinbase. Is,
like,
right?
Is that right? Like a lot of folks would say something like, okay, if we started putting out simplified messaging like that, or if Muslim communities or scholars are putting them.
I think it's right for the right.
Why are we oversimplifying? Why are we turning like our complex philosophical approach into something that's essentially like bouncing on your screen?
I think it's only right when it calls for it. Like Coinbase, if you go to their site, you probably get a lot more. I haven't been to Coinbase's site, but like I think everywhere else it gets it. But this is how you grab the attention, and then they go into more detail. I think it's for the attention grabbing. Because any kind of ad on a Super Bowl is not to like give you the story of what the product is. There was one ad that it was somebody driving a car, and I only saw the car for the last 1 second of the video, and it was a car ad. The rest of the time, I was just seeing like trees and people playing outside and somebody just driving, right? So the fact that like I feel that because no commercial really gives you the whole idea, no trailer gives you the full story, this was the trailer that was able to actually get my attention the most out of everything that we saw.
I guess I just wonder, like, are we okay with the idea of, like, on one hand, you don't want to, like, you like, we need to make sure that, like, in order to build a movement, we make things simple, right? Like, one of the things that, and I'm not a scholar, and, like, you know, I don't pretend to be, but one of the things about the prophetic tradition, Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, is that he, Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, was a person who could speak in a way that was very simple and short. So on one hand, like, of course, we want to make sure that things are simple and easy for people to understand. On the other hand, you wonder, like, are we just creating a world in which, like, you kind of have to be like a master of digital marketing in order to have your good ideas out there? Like, if you have some brilliant academic or a brilliant scholar or an artist who's working on this incredible work but doesn't know how to make the bouncy thing on the screen, like, how are we, like, and then, you know, you wonder about also about like a lot of, you know, organizations like ours, like, what's our role in making knowledge simple, but also not in like dumbing it down to the point that it's meaningless?
I think the world decides that. I don't think it's like for us to decide. I think it's our job is to decide what the world is, to play to the rules of what the world is and what the audience looks like, right? So like, I would say easily a couple of years ago, so let's say 10 years ago, people were not listening to like this kind of form in a podcast form, right? People were not, you know, people had attention spans to watch a more of a documentary style. And now the people that watch a documentary style, like we've all seen, have gone down, and people have the attention span to last 7 seconds on a TikTok video.
And even that's too much.
So I think it really is like,
it really is.
Right. So like, I think the market is the indicator. And the market has those fluctuations where they have their high times and they have their low times, right? Years ago, the high time for the market would have been to do a Twitter thread. And now we both know that Twitter threads only work sometimes, right? Like before it was like do an Instagram post, and now Instagram posts have no reach, but what it is you have to do an Instagram reel, right? By doing an hour long YouTube video for the right audience hits, but most of them would rather sit for a 7 second to 12 second video, right, on TikTok or IG Reels or YouTube, right? So I think it really just depends on the audience. And I think the market is the indicator. I don't know if it's something that, you know, we can dictate how the market looks at it. And I feel like they're always going to have that audience that's going to like one or the other, right? I think for us, it's just making sure that we are getting the most kind of bang for the buck. And I think the best example would be like looking at like the market indicator of email marketing versus text message marketing, right? Like 20 years ago, email marketing was like the greatest thing that you could have ever done because everybody opened an email. And now my personal email, I have like 20,000 emails that I haven't opened, right? I think that it kind of just adapts and goes through it like over time. And I don't think it's something that we don't get to dictate that. We just have to play by the rules of what the market
is. I don't know, man. It's a real issue for me. Like,
but I do agree. I think digital marketers take it over. I think people like, you know, digital marketing firms are what people need to have for every organization. And I think that's just going through it. I think that brings us to an end.
I was just going to say to our audience, it was a great, we invite you to like let us know what you think about any of the things that we're talking about. How do you think NCCM should deal with the fact that the government is invoking the Emergencies Act? How do you think NCCM should be dealing with the convoy protests? Let us know, you know, what do you think about digital marketing? You know, and how do you think that, you know, should we be keeping messages as simple as possible? Or should we really be, you know, trying to complexify things and show people a different kind of way of approaching things? Are those mutually exclusive, and how does that all work?
You can use a hashtag profiled for anyone that's on Twitter, on Instagram. Use hashtag profiled and give us your answers. Give us your responses. Add us here. You can, you know, find Mustafa on social media. You can find myself on social media at Your Muslim Brother. You can tag NCCM or on Instagram, NCCM_community. And let us know what you think. Let us know what you think of this episode of the hashtags going forward. And, you know, also, I think you bring up a good point. I think we could probably do a whole episode talking about, like, talking to nonprofit work about how our future is supposed to look in the digital marketing space, and having those kind of guests on that actually bring that. But I think that brings us to an end today. Thank you, Mustafa, for coming today. Thank you, Stephen, for spending your time with us, for coming out today. Again, you can find Stephen on his Twitter account. Please give him a follow. His work and his insight is always really, really amazing. Like I said, he had a long Twitter thread about his, you know, experience talking to folks at the protest in Toronto. You can follow please follow NCCM on all of our social medias, NCCM on Facebook, on Twitter, and we'd be happy to reach out to you guys and have this kind of conversation. So thank you guys so much. Thank you for tuning in today. I hope you guys enjoy the conversation, and we'll see you guys next week. Masalam.